I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
This week, we have poet Paisley Rekdal, who just came out with two books this year. So we'll be talking a little bit about both of them. One is called Intimate, or is it Intimate?
I think it's Intimate, but
I thought it was Intimate too, but it might be Intimate.
Yes.
Because it's an interesting book.
Yes.
It's a hybrid. It's got poetry, it's got nonfiction, it's got photos, and it's a really interesting book. Look forward to talking to her about it. And from the Pitts Poetry Series, her new collection of poems, which is called Animal Eye. And she'll also be doing our Poem of the Week.
And
on Poetic License,
we have
our own Benjamin Alida Sainz, who is going to talk about aging.
Aging. There's a thought.
That's an interesting subject, Ben. Why do you want to talk about aging?
Well, I just think it's really interesting the different ways that people age, because we all age, but we don't age the same.
Yeah.
And it's both physical and emotional. So I just want to have a reflection on that.
You know what's interesting about aging from my perspective? I just turned 50 years old this year.
And you look 40.
Oh, well, you know, 50's the new 40, they say. And it's sometimes very strange to think of myself as 50. And maybe it's because I've never had kids. Right? I've been married a few times, but I've never had kids. And sometimes when I, like, go to a doctor, I expect the doctor to be this old Marcus Welby-looking white guy who's going to walk out, and I'm going to call him sir. But 9 times out of 10,
they're younger than
younger than me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, really interesting.
And I don't think I've seen a cop younger, older than me since I was a kid.
Well, I'm 58, and I still wear Chuck Taylors. And
I don't even know what that means.
Chuck Taylors?
Yeah, what is Chuck Taylors?
MBAs. They're tennis shoes.
Oh.
Chuck Taylors.
Sorry, I wasn't a tennis shoe dude when I was a kid.
And, you know, someone...
I thought you wore Vans.
No, I don't wear Vans.
Oh, anyway, somebody told you.
That I don't dress my age.
Yeah. You dress like a teenager. Like one of your characters in a YA novel.
Well, that's how I dress.
But it looks good on you. It wouldn't make sense for you to try to dress any other way. You know, you wear your tennis shoes, you wear your, you know, your jeans, and it just, you know, it looks right. It's your look.
It's my look.
Absolutely. You know, and the other thing about that I find interesting about aging is when I was in a grad school at Fresno State, I had a teacher, Steve Yarbrough, who's a novelist. Anyway, he told us, he says, he was talking about this new writer. He's talking to class this. He says, he's a new young writer. He's very young and he's new and he's exciting. And somebody in the class says, how old is he? And he goes, 40. And I thought, new, young, that's like an old man. And here I am, you know, still publishing in my 50s. But now I understand a 40-year-old writer is pretty young.
It's pretty young. And I had one of my students once say, he was talking about an experience that he had in Alaska. And he says, and I work with this old guy. He was like 37.
Yeah. And you know, the thing about being a young writer is when you get published, it usually takes a couple of years for the book to come out. And so you publish every 5 years. Well, unless you're Ben, you publish 2 books a year. Speaking of young writers, we have a very young and brilliant poet with us today, Paisley Rekdal. And look forward to talking to her when we get back.
So stay tuned.
Paisley Rekdal is the author of a book of essays, The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee, and 3 books of poetry, A Crash of Rhinos, 6 Girls Without Pants, and The Invention of the Kaleidoscope. She received the Village Voice Writers on the Verge Award, an NEA Fellowship, the University of Georgia Press Contemporary Poetry Series Award, a Fulbright Fellowship, Pushcart Prize, and the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Fellowship. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, NPR, The New Republic, Poetry, Tin House, the Kenyon Review. And this year she has 2 new books, Intimate, a hybrid photo text memoir that combines poems, nonfiction, and fiction with photography, and Animal Eye, a collection of poems from the Pitt Poetry Series. And today we'll be talking about both of those. Welcome to the show, Paisley.
Welcome, Paisley.
Thank you so much.
You know, you're in Utah, aren't you?
I am in Utah.
So what is the writer's life like in Utah? I imagine with the natural beauty there, the snowy mountains and the trees, that it can really contribute or reinforce your quite obvious love for landscape.
You know, it's funny, since I grew up in cities and lived in very urban areas around the world most of my life, I had not been interested in landscape at all, and it really wasn't until moving to Utah that I became fascinated with it and was really just blown away, like you said, by the beauty of this landscape. And I think it does inspire writers. Obviously, Terry Tempest Williams is here, and she's written very movingly and very powerfully about the connection of especially Mormon settlers and the legacy of Mormons in Salt Lake and around the area with a landscape. It's a really rich writing culture here because where I teach, the University of Utah has a PhD in creative writing program. So we get a ton of students from around the country wanting to come here. And a lot of them stay, or I shouldn't say a lot of them, a number of them stay. We have a lot of, and it's generated a lot of community interest in writing in general. So this place is kind of lousy with poets, to be honest. And I wouldn't say that all of us are as inspired or equally inspired by nature. In fact, this seems to be kind of a home for increasingly conceptual writing, which really is very far away from the pastoral literary tradition in a lot of respects. So it's been exciting to sort of talk to and be among other writers that do very different things. But all of us are, I think, fascinated by the landscape. And it's not just a geographical landscape that's amazing, but it's a political landscape. It's a cultural landscape. I mean, it's all these sorts of layers that people are responding to. This next semester, I'm really excited. I'm going to be teaching a nonfiction class called Mapping Salt Lake City.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm giving each student, assigning them a neighborhood or an area of Salt Lake all the way to West Valley and some of the places where the Tongans and the Samoans have settled. And they're going to write essays, you know, doing research, historical research, thinking about what this place means to so many of the communities that have been here.
But, you know, Paisley, your work does have a lot of landscape in it, but it's also conceptual.
Well, that's nice to hear, actually. I like, yeah, I mean.
No, it is.
Well, I was thinking, I think that might be true, especially for Intimate, that the newest project, or I should say one of the newest projects that just was published, because it's basically like a braided memoir. I mean, it's got this story of Edward Curtis, it's got the story of his crow guide, Alexander Upshaw, and then, of course, the story of my parents woven into it. It's got poems, and it was conceptual, I think, ultimately, in its formal development, because I had to think about how to put all of these stories together, and I was really taken when I was doing a lot of research, but I was doing a lot of research on everything, including, of course, the history of photography, and one of the classic texts that you read is, of course, Susan Sontag's On Photography, and she said something I thought was brilliant. She said, you know, a literary fragment is a snapshot. Mm-hmm. And when I thought about that, it all sort of snapped into place, which is that, you know, what I'm really trying to do is create a photo album, and so to think about chunks of fragments, literary fragments, poetic fragments, memoir fragments, and putting those together as a kind of photo album. And like most photo albums, at first it may look disorganized, but after you start to read it through, there's actually a narrative that is sort of tightly woven, I hope, you know, together between, you know, these different strands, these different individuals. And so I think that is probably the most conceptual thing I've done.
When I was going through your book, Intimate, that's the question I asked myself, is that how did you go about learning how to organize this book?
Oh, man, it was a nightmare.
I bet it was.
7 years. I started thinking, when I first was looking at Edward Curtis's photographs, and I grew up with them, but I just sort of never knew what they were because I grew up in Seattle, and he had a studio in Seattle, and there were just these images everywhere, these famous, these iconic portraits of these Native Americans. And I sort of took it for granted, I think, like a lot of people in the Northwest did, of this beauty. So I thought when I finally started, you know, looking at it and thinking about it, I thought, well, this will just be a short series of poems. And then it became obvious that the poems couldn't get into some of the complexities that Curtis's work raises, which is when he fakes some of these very famous shots, when he erases things and when he poses people and when he works against that documentary impulse and tries to make it an artistic production, suddenly he takes away a certain way of thinking about authenticity that we might feel more comfortable with. And so I thought, well, I can't get that in a poem as easily. You almost have to say that. So I thought, well, I'll just write an essay that goes with the poems. And then that was falling flat. I kept thinking, why am I really bothered by this? Why does it bother me so much about this issue of representation? And the more I thought about it, and at the time my mother was undergoing treatments for some pretty serious cancer problems that she was having, and it really became interesting to me to see how bodies get represented in illness, how they're treated in illness, how people sort of move in and out of sort of being themselves and then just being bodies that are cared for. And I can't really articulate what it was about that, but suddenly all of it started to move into place, which is, I mean, representation and identity are things that all of us are obsessed with in one way or another. And I think with race, it just becomes so immediately apparent the ways in which we choose to represent ourselves and the ways in which we visually represent other people, people who are not like ourselves. And I think that, you know, being someone who's mixed race, like I said, my mother's Chinese American, my father's a mixture of whites, mostly Norwegian, you know, it just became something that I was personally quite interested in. And what interested me also is I was doing the research for this project and I would talk to people and, you know, and I did readings down here in southern Utah as well on a couple of reservations, and people would come up to me afterwards and say, are you, which tribe are you from? You know, and I would be like, no, I'm not, you know, because I've got this appearance that can sort of blend in potentially depending on the context. And I was fascinated by that, this idea of, like, who owns what kinds of stories, how do they get told, and what kind of investment we have in them.
We're talking to Paisley Rekdal, whose new book, Intimate, an American Family Photo Album, is a very interesting hybrid of poetry, memoir, nonfiction. It, three major threads in terms of the writing. There's the story of Edward Curtis, the photographer, and then the poet and her family, the little bit of your family in there. And then one of the most interesting figures who I suppose for me has metaphorical meaning when I think of the indigenous Mexicans and how the conquest could not have been achieved in the way that it was without these particular guides. And here you have this interesting character named Alexander Upshaw, and he's a very important part of this book. Can you talk a little bit about him and his role?
Yeah, Upshaw was somebody who I didn't want to bring into this at all.
so you did, but he asserted himself, I guess.
I really, because I didn't want to do what I think is inevitable when writing about this, which is to turn into another kind of Edward Curtis. And I acknowledge that I do that in the book. I Curtis myself by trying to imagine that this, what this person's life was like. Upshaw was a real person. He really worked for Edward Curtis. He left a scattered record. And what, to a certain extent, we know about him, we know as much through the photographs that were taken of him and left as we do as any written record that he himself had left or any of the activities he'd engaged in. He had worked for Crow Rights very hard towards the end of his life, and that's the reason he was murdered, actually. But he began life in a very different way, which was that he was raised in Carlisle, the famous school in Pennsylvania that was all about this idea of assimilation, above all things, assimilation. So they would take kids from all of these different tribes and essentially say, you can be American if you do all of these things, which I find fascinating. Of course, the idea of Americanness is they were born here, but they're still not American, right? They don't get that citizenship granted to them. For them, it's an entire cultural process to earn it. And one of the things that, one of the records that Upshaw did leave was one of those classic essays in which he basically parrots the school party line, which is, and I quote a little bit of it in the book, where he says, you know, this is the whole thing about being an American. If we work hard, if we follow Christian ways, if we, you know, educate ourselves, we completely leave behind all of these native customs and enter this world, we'll, you know, this is how we become Americans. And he moves from that slowly, and I think, I have to imagine this because I don't know, he moves from that to somebody who suddenly is very committed to native rights and very committed to living on a reservation and very committed to making sure that the Crow are treated well and thinking very much about his Crow identity and what that means.
You've had a pretty good year. 2012 has been a great year for you. You had another book come out called Animal Eye, which is part of the Pitts Poetry series. Can you tell us a little bit about this book?
Yeah, that one. It seems so easy to write in retrospect because it wasn't so conceptual. It wasn't so difficult formally to frame it. I mean, it was literally just sitting down and writing some poems and over the course of time seeing how they work together. To a certain extent, I see these as companion books, too. Yeah. Both of them are obsessed with vision, imagination versus sight,
yeah.
The idea of really seeing or experiencing versus imagining or witnessing. You know, what does it mean to witness something? I think part of it came from the fact that I was teaching courses on visual poetry and then also documentary poetics, which really obsesses me, this idea of, like, a poem as a document and what that would mean. So Animal Eye, I think it kind of reflects those kinds of obsessions, too. There's a long poem.
Eastern Lisbon?
Eastern Lisbon, that's one, yeah. There's two long poems, yeah. Eastern Lisbon deals with, it's a narrative that braids together two stories, which is the, actually just one story, but it's a sort of fraught relationship I had with a man who's African-American. We were both traveling together in Spain and Portugal. And this was right around the time of the race riots in L.A. after the Rodney King beatings and the trial and everything. And we'd been living together, actually, in Ireland in the same dormitory, and we were good friends. And we went on that trip, and it was the most explosive and insane sort of trip because I think, for me, it was really eye-opening. I had never seen what it would be like to be black in any kind of context. And we had run into so many events. You know, people would just—it was the south of Spain. People would scream at us in cafes. People, you know, women would stop by and just yell at him for sitting close to me at all. We went across the border. He was pulled off the bus along with an African who had been there too, and they were just questioned for hours. And then they found out that I was with them, and then I was pulled in. It was just. And I said to him, I was like, how do you, I mean, I was like, is this what it's like? And he goes, yeah, you just don't, he's like, after a while, you just have to stop seeing things. And that always stayed with me. And then, of course, the poem also recounts, you know, spending this day finally on my own in this zoo that goes horribly awry. Basically, this cage has got all of these, you know, thousands of different lemurs in it, and the guards just didn't care. There's all these little baby lemurs kind of, like, running everywhere, like, out in the open. And so I thought about this idea of what is the zoo, but a sort of metaphor for kind of prison we're all in of identity and race, and what it would be like to actually be in a place where the zoo, you know, breaks open. And you know, talked about the kind of, you know, imperialist nostalgia that I was not aware that I had. I mean, I always sort of... It's always one of those things that everyone says, oh, yeah, I'm racist, in this sort of, like, self-congratulatory way. But I think it really was this, you know, kind of shock of awakening that why was I thinking this in a zoo, especially with the Rodney King thing going in the background, and how that was really affecting our relationship, too. And you know, even though politically we're on the same side, suddenly I just thought, wow, there's just so many differences of sight and self-consciousness.
We have this segment called Poem of the Week, and would you be willing to read one of your poems from this book for us?
Oh, sure. I should probably choose a short one.
Personally, I really liked Why Some Girls Love Horses and Arctic Scale. Both of those just blew me away.
I'll read Why Some Girls Love Horses. Why Some Girls Love Horses. And then I thought, can I have more of this? Would it be possible for every day to be a greater awakening? More light, more light. Your face on the pillow with the sleep creases rudely fragmenting it. Hair so stiff from paint and sheetrock, it feels like the dirty short hank of mane I used to grab on Dandy's neck before he hauled me up and forward. White flanks flecked green with shit and the satin of his dander. The livingness, the warmth of all that blood just under the skin and in the long, thick muscle of the neck. He was smarter than most of the children I went to school with. He knew how to stand with just the crescent of his hoof along a boot toe and press incrementally his whole weight down. The pain, so surprising when it came, its iron intention sheathed in stealth, the decisive, sudden twisting of his leg until the hoof pinned one's foot completely to the ground. We'd have to beat and beat him with a brush to push him off, that hot insistence with its large horse eye trained deliberately on us to watch. Like us, he knew how to announce through violence how he didn't hunger, didn't want, despite our practiced ministrations, too young not to try to empathize with this cunning, this thing that was and was not human we must respect for itself and not our imagination of it. I loved him because I could not love him any more in the ways I'd taught myself, watching the slim bodies of teenagers guide their geldings and figure eights around the ring as if they were one body, one fluid motion of electric understanding I would never feel working its way through fingers to the bit. This thing had a name, a need, a personality. It possessed an indifference that gave me logic and a measure. I, too, might stop wanting the hand placed on back or shoulder and never feel the desired response. I love the horse for the pain it could imagine and inflict on me, the sudden jerking of head away from halter, the tentative nose inspecting first before it might decide to relent and eat. I loved what was not slave or instinct, that when you turn to me, it is a choice. It is always a choice to imagine pleasure might be blended, one warmth bleeding into another as the future bleeds into the past. More light, more light. Your hand against my shoulder. The image of the one who taught me disobedience is the first right of being alive.
That was lovely.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire, Paisley.
We've been talking to Paisley Rekdal, who has two books this year, Intimate, An American Family Photo Album, and Animal Eye from the Pitts Poetry Series. Thank you so much, Paisley.
Thank you so much.
I'm Benjamin Alida Sines with this week's Poetic License. I was thinking the other day about this thing that we call aging, and I decided that I wanted to write down a few reflections on that, being that I turned 58 this year. And that sounds so old, and yet it doesn't feel like that. My experience of being 58 doesn't feel old. I don't know exactly what it feels like, so I wrote down these reflections. A few weeks ago, I looked across at Daniel Chacon, my friend and colleague, and thought to myself, he's 50. He looks like he's 40. And he does look like he's 40. Maybe it's all genetic, this stuff about aging, about how old or how young you look, or how old or young you feel. My mother was a young woman all her life until she got sick and died. She was the youngest woman I've ever known. She was so full of energy and generosity, a heart full of gratitude for each new day. She didn't know how to waste time. She didn't know what it was to be bored. And then there was my grandfather, my father's father. God, that man was young. He remarried at 74. His second marriage lasted 20 years. He outlived both his wives. He kept his disciplined grief in check and lived the last years of his life with a grace and a joyous heart. When I greeted him, I always asked him how he was. His answer was always the same. Hijito de mi vida, encantado de haber nacido. Enchanted to have been born. I've never had a student in my class who was as young as my grandfather. And then there's a strange case of my father who was, in my eyes, always old. I don't know what made him that way. He was angry and tired, and he let the world take away his youth. It wasn't the alcohol. My father stopped drinking when I was in the fourth grade, never drank again. But already, he was a ghost. Something beautiful and necessary had left him. I don't think he understood very much about happiness. Maybe anger robs you of that thing we call youth. I'm 58. Some days, I feel like a boy. Some days, I act like an adolescent. Some days, I'm a perfectly mature man who, acts his age, whatever the hell that means. I confess that sometimes I study my face in the mirror. I study the lines. I suppose you could say they give me character, that and my gray hair. Frankly, I don't mind my aging body. I've grown quite fond of the lines on my face. It's as if they are markers of the life I have lived. I wear my worries, my joys, my hurts, my successes, all on my face. I carry the shape of my life in my body, and with each step I take, my legs are still strong enough to bear the weight of whatever my days bring. The human body, life, aging, all these things are such a mystery. I'm no doctor or scientist. I can't explain aging and youth and old age and middle age and all those categories we use to translate the passing of the days and months and years. But aging isn't something we need to understand. It's something we need to experience. It's something that we live. I know that I am growing older. I also know that I want to wear my Chuck Taylors and 501 Levi's until the day I die. I don't envy the young people around me. I've been through the hell of youth and come out the other side. Young people may be beautiful, but they don't know a damn thing about appreciating beauty, not even their own. At my age, I don't have to be pretty or handsome anymore. I'm free now to touch the lines on my own face after I shave, then give myself a smile, put on the coffee, and sit down to write. I have a confession to make. When I sit and write and listen to jazz, I am the youngest man in the world. When I write down something that I know to be real, my heart skips a beat. I am reaching out to touch something transcendent, something greater than myself. I am reaching out, always reaching out. Yes, yes, when I am writing, I am the youngest man in the world. This is Benjamin Alida Sainz for Words on a Wire. We'd like to thank Paisley Richtoff for being on our show, Words on a Wire, today.
Thank you, Ben, for your words on aging.
My pleasure. It's always my pleasure to do another Poetic License. Though, I think we need to have other voices being heard here.
Yeah,
so
what's up with
send
that?
Send in your Poetic License, you poets and writers and nonfiction writers out there.
And think of it as a publication, because the fact is, one of the things that Ben and I are working on is after maybe another 6 months or so, we're going to take the best of Poetic License. And not only are we going to do an entire show called The Best of the Poetic License, but we're also going to put together an anthology for publication. So write a Poetic License, give us a call, email us, and we will put you on the air.
Send them in. We have the porch light on for you. Thank you again for listening to this week's edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And don't forget,
the next book you read
could save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top end.